Thanks to Royal Canin for making this month's podcast possible. An adverse food reaction could be hiding beneath allergic dermatitis signs. Recommend a food elimination trial for skin issues with nutritional support from Ultimino to see what's really going on. Detect, protect, and connect with Royal Canin. Hello and welcome to NextPod, VP NextGen's podcast made for veterinary students and young professionals who want to know what's next. I'm your host, Sarah Said, and today we will be discussing the use of the diet trial in practice to help make the diagnosis of canine food allergies easier. Here to discuss this is Dr. Megan Painter, a board-certified veterinary dermatologist currently practicing at Angel West, just outside of Boston, and founder of CE course, The Allergic Dog. Welcome, Dr. Painter.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful opportunity to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And before we start our podcast, we always like to ask some questions about our special guest. So the first few questions I have for you is really just like, can you give us, you know, a little breakdown of what college/university did you attend and what really made you want to get into this career in the first place?
Totally. So I started my life as a 15-year-old volunteer at an animal shelter, and 15 years later ended up going to veterinary school. So I went to Tufts University as an undergraduate and was a philosophy major because it was there that I was told I was bad at science. And so that set me back a little bit. And I honestly wasn't very good at science then, so they weren't wrong. But I was very good at philosophy and writing and thinking critically, and all of those skills that I reinforced as an undergraduate have really helped me in my path as a veterinarian. So I definitely was able to use those skills and eventually went on to run a big animal shelter in Boston, but knew that that just wasn't forever. And I started dipping my toe in the water and maybe doing science courses again, and it was working out well for me. And so I went to Tufts again for veterinary school and graduated and had a pretty good intention that I wanted to do dermatology when I started my internship, went on to, you know, have my residency, 3-year residency, and then pass my boards and work full-time in California. And here I am back in Boston, which is where I'm from. So it's been an awesome journey, and, you know, there's so much to do in veterinary practice. So just never doubt yourself. If this is really, you know, what you want to do, you'll get there.
Yeah, I really love that. I mean, it's so funny. Sometimes when you're going through the motions, like in school and stuff, you're like, oh, somebody told me I'm bad at this. There's no way I can do it. You know, it's so easy to give up. So I love that you said that. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And it's just, there's so much to life, you know, and there's ups and downs, and it's all just one day at a time.
Mm-hmm. So I'm actually just going to jump right into my questions. Great. Know we want to talk about some, we want to talk about diet trials. But before we get there, can you explain to start off why skin issues are complex to diagnose in the first place?
Yes. Okay. So as general practitioners, emergency clinicians, house call veterinarians, you are going to be dealing with canine skin and ear infections, itch, all of that every single day. It's a very common problem. But the problem with canine skin and ear disease is that there are numerous differentials for what can cause that manifestation. So there's lots of reasons why dogs can get a pyoderma, not just allergy. There's lots of reasons why you might have an ear infection, not just allergy. But canine allergy is very common. And so I think one of the trickiest things is making sure that as veterinarians, we remember that our job is to make a diagnosis. So we want to be confident and efficient and make sure that we, when we see our patient, we know what we're treating them for, and that we're not just kind of saying, oh, this must be allergies because he has an ear infection, because, you know, it could be a tumor, it could be a foreign body. There's something that you might miss if you kind of blindside yourself and say, oh, it's always allergy. But the complexity of the, you know, you can see one dog that's just itchy, and then one dog with an ear infection, and then one dog with a, you know, pododermatitis. And so there are lots of manifestations of canine allergy. So it's common, but you don't want to miss something, but there's lots of things that it can look like. So it really takes time, and it takes a lot of practice to be sure that you're rechecking your patients and you're making sure that, okay, I think this dog has allergies. I'm going to treat him accordingly. I want to get him back in the exam room in 6 to 8 weeks. And that's hard. You know, people don't come back to their rechecks. You know, they can't afford it, you know, whatever. There's so many different things that can get in the way of actually making this diagnosis correctly. And I think that's the most challenging part, is just making sure that you feel like, okay, I know that this dog has allergies and I know what is driving that allergy. I spend a lot of time focusing on that in my patients, because I just want to be sure I'm not missing a food allergy. I'm not missing, you know, some sort of skin cancer, or I'm not missing scabies, you know, something else that could cause this dog to have this manifestation. Because in the end, those are things that are, you know, to be honest, slightly easier to manage than pollen, you know? So if it's an environmental allergy and that's what we end up with as a diagnosis of exclusion, then, you know, this is something that this dog's going to have lifelong and can be difficult to manage.
So in terms of the diet trials themselves, when does that come into play for you? What are the steps that kind of you do prior to getting to that point?
Great. So when you have the consideration that you potentially should be looking at doing a diet trial for your patient, you'll get there because you've seen your dog, and we're going to talk about dogs in this podcast. Cats are a whole other, you know, they're not small dogs. There are a lot of considerations for cats. I have an allergic cat. I have a course called The Allergic Cat coming out. So I definitely feel that cats need and deserve time, but we see primarily as veterinarians dogs. So I'm going to spend this podcast talking about dogs. So you have a dog that's coming into your clinic. The dog has itch, you know, it's itchy. It's licking its paws at night. It maybe has some ear infections. And then another, you know, big clue that we potentially could have a food allergy issue is the fact that the dog might have some GI signs. So softer stool than what's considered normal, or an increased frequency of defecation. Those are two major clues that food allergy could be part of this dog's problem. And so at that point, we want to say, well, how do we diagnose that? How do we make the diagnosis? Because again, that's our job as veterinarians. We're doctors. We want to have a diagnosis so that we know the problem. We can then say, this is the prognosis for this problem, and this is the treatment for this problem. And so when we're confronted with a dog that has non-seasonal itch, it's not varying. You know, you're not going to be allergic to chicken in August, right? So if you have a patient that's coming to you every August, but then is clinically normal for the rest of the year, it's probably not a food allergy. But if you have a dog that's continuously paretic, always itchy, always in the clinic, always having ear infections, always licking their paws, and has soft poop all the time, that dog's a food allergic dog until proven otherwise. And what you want to do is realize that the diet trial is actually the only diagnostic test in your toolkit to make that diagnosis. So that's when you say, okay, I'm going to get serious and I'm going to do a diet trial and I'm going to do it the right way. And that's what we're going to, I think, spend today talking about, is just making sure that the diet trial is done appropriately so that you actually get a good answer from it.
And when you say diet trial, is that food elimination diet, or is there kind of another way to go about that?
There are lots of words for the diet trial. What we mean when we say diet trial, I personally say the term diagnostic diet trial. I believe I have coined that. So the diagnostic diet trial, and I like putting that word in there because what it implies is that we're using this test, because that's what it is, to make a diagnosis of food allergy and to rule in or out food allergy, right? So I often will say that what we're trying to do is determine the percentage of the problem that's driven by food. And so if we can say, oh, 100% of this dog's problem just went away because we fed him Royal Canin HP, well, great. We just nailed it. You know, we help that dog a lot by figuring out their diagnosis. But if they're not 100% better, and there might be some, you know, variability in there, which we can talk about too, those can be difficult to pick up. But the point is that we're trying to use this diet trial to determine the percentage of the problem that's driven by food. So whatever you call it, it's still a test to make a diagnosis of food allergy. So the elimination diet trial, the diagnostic diet trial, the diet trial, feed this food, you know, all of these things are used to say, hey, pet owner, we want you to do this thing in your home. And what that sets up is this big problem, right? Because now the pet owner is in charge of this test. And we're as veterinarians used to being the ones who are in charge of the test, you know, drawing the blood and saying, okay, you know, we got a CBC and your platelets were low. Well, you can't do that for food allergy because the diagnostic diet trial is the only test to determine if a dog has specific allergies to specific items or if they clinically resolve when you feed them a diet that they're not sensitized to. So it's the only test to determine cutaneous adverse food reaction or food allergy in the dog.
Yeah. And I kind of want to talk a little bit more about that hesitation, I guess, that might come with doing these diet trials, whether it's from the veterinarian or the client. We'll start with the veterinarian. Is there something like a reluctance there, or it's not usually top of mind for practitioners to do?
Yeah, I think a lot of veterinarians worry that it's going to be hard for pet owners to do. And that's actually a very valid worry. My research during my residency looked at adherence to diet trials, which is basically people or pet owners' ability to follow through 100% on the recommendation to be strict. Because the main rule for the diagnostic diet trial is that it's an 8-week diagnostic test where you're feeding one food very strictly. So what you don't want is to have a lot of, you know, treats being given or pill pockets or, you know, cream cheese used for medication, or they're eating the other dog's food, or they're picking up the toddler's food. There are a lot of barriers that would get in the way of someone performing a diet trial well and to a diagnostic standard. And our goal as veterinarians is to make a diagnosis. So we want this diet trial to be done to a diagnostic standard. And so I think a lot of veterinarians worry that they won't be able to coach pet owners appropriately so that then when they do the diet trial, it's actually done correctly. And so instead they say, oh, we'll just try this food and see if it helps. When really it's just a waste of time if we're doing that, because we're not going to get an answer if a pet owner is feeding, you know, a special hydrolyzed food, but also given, you know, the dog all sorts of stuff or scraps from the table. And so it's, or daycare, you know, there's so many ways that dogs can get off limit items during this 8-week test. And so it's so important for veterinarians just to have some language in their back pocket to use when talking with pet owners to say, okay, how are you going to give medication during this trial? Let's talk about that. Okay, you have another dog. What's your plan for feeding them separately? And just, I think veterinarians really need to remember that these are other human beings that have their own barriers and issues and schedules and lifestyles and things that could make this difficult. And that's not a problem. We just need to talk about it. And we need to say, all right, how are you feeling about doing this? Needs to be strict, needs to be 8 weeks. Well, I have a vacation coming up, so maybe I should postpone it. Great, great idea. Let's start it February 1st, you know, whatever. So having these conversations, I think for veterinarians, one, takes time, but also can just really help make it so that when we are recommending it, we're recommending it for a reason and we feel good about that recommendation. You know, we can stand behind it and say, I'm doing a diagnostic test for your dog. It's important.
Yeah. And how can veterinarians in the first place, like sort of guide owners to even seeing the signs of these potential allergies and like, you know, what kind of advice do you have in that regard?
I mean, that's one of the hardest parts, I think, is just to label what's going on. And so instead of, you know, looking at a dog with an ear infection as a dog with an ear infection, you should look at a dog with an ear infection as an alarm bell for another primary problem. You know, so it's really dialing back on the symptom and saying, why is this symptom happening? So when it comes to skin and ear disease, it is very rarely going to just be itself, right? So it's always going to have a trigger. It's always going to have a primary source. So if a dog has a skin infection, there's a reason for that. And that reason is usually allergies. But of course, we could have endocrine disease or, you know, other issues with their health. So figuring out why that's happening is, I think, the first major step. And if we can isolate the primary cause, then we're able to prevent all the secondary issues, right? So if we're able to say, oh, wow, I just solved this problem and this dog actually has food allergy, they're not going to be coming into your clinic every 3 months for another ear infection that won't go away. So it suits us as veterinarians to do this well, because it increases trust, it increases, you know, patient care for sure. I mean, our goal is just to make our patients feel better. And if we can figure out why this is happening, then we will absolutely stand a much better chance of making a difference for them in the long term, and helping them, you know, with their actual diagnosis and their actual problem.
Mm-hmm. And you said that, you know, there's multiple things that could cause a certain symptom. So, but I have the question here of like, what are the four typical sources of skin issues in dogs?
So allergies being number one, a huge number one. So they're the most common, but you also have to think about your dog population. So if you're looking at a 2 to 8 year old dog with issues, that's different than if you're looking at a 15 year old dog with new problems. So it is very important to pay attention to your signalment. And when you're looking at, you know, the age of the dog, the other comorbidities, other medications that the dog is on, that's essential when you're trying to kind of, you know, create a differentials list for some sort of skin manifestation. But if we're just talking, you know, one of the reasons I love my job is because the majority of my patients have allergic skin and ear disease and they're otherwise very healthy. So typically what we're seeing are these very healthy young dogs that are presenting with this skin issue of itch, ear infection, bacterial pyoderma, pododermatitis, scooting, you know, GI signs, all of that. And they're otherwise happy. Like they're going on hikes every day, but they're just itchy. And so allergies is like number one, number two, number three in that. But we also see a lot of endocrine disease, ectoparasitic disease. So something like scabies can make a dog wildly itchy. And it's a real bummer to miss that one because it's so treatable. You'll cure the dog. I think the average time that a dog with scabies has been treated for something other than scabies when I see them has been 8 to 12 months. So they're being treated for allergies, but they're actually, they have scabies, you know, so things like this are pretty basic, and good to just rule out. And, in my course, we talk a lot about actually like how to rule, how to make this diagnosis of canine allergy so that you can feel confident in that. But allergy, endocrine, ectoparasites, and then neoplasia. So we do see skin cancers that can be very itchy and red. So an inflammation on the skin and a lot of itch that's driving, you know, the dog to come into you. So that would be the top four, but it is, you know, you're dangerous because you really want to separate those out appropriately based on what you're seeing clinically.
Yeah, for sure. And I was wondering if you could actually explain the difference between an adverse food reaction and then food intolerance for people as well.
Yeah. So this is like just a matter of semantics. So there's four different, an adverse food reaction basically is the catch-all term. And then under that you have immunologic and non-immunologic reactions to food. And so a true immunologic reaction to food is something like a peanut allergy in a child, where you'll have a type one hypersensitivity, where it's an immediate hypersensitivity response to what they ate. In dogs, we don't see this happen commonly, but we do see this. And this will be your patient who presents to the ER with recurrent hives and diarrhea. So dogs, their main anaphylactic organ is going to be their liver and the hepatobiliary system. So they'll often present with some hives, but oftentimes a history of vomiting or diarrhea as a result of that exposure and their histamine release. But true IgE hypersensitivity driven by food in dogs is not very common. And that's the reason why we don't have blood or skin tests for food allergens in dogs. So the other non-immunologic, or we do have immunologic bases, but it in dogs, their adverse food reaction is immunologically based. And we'll talk about non-immunologic too, but the non-IgE is what I meant to say, where you have this non-IgE based food reaction. And those are where you're having your type 2, 3, and 4 hypersensitivity reactions, which are less measurable, but still quite dramatic, where you'll have the skin symptoms and potentially the GI signs. And that does involve the immune response. It does involve a lack of tolerance at the immune level, but it isn't something that is 100% driven by a type 1 hypersensitivity or IgE. Then you have non-immunologic responses, and that's like botulism or food poisoning. So that's basically just where you ate food and the food itself made you very sick. And that obviously would be an adverse reaction to food, but your immune system is not what's driving that reaction. So just to review that again, you have adverse food reactions, which covers anything bad that occurs after you eat something. And then you have immunologic and non-immunologic. Immunologic is really what we focus on a lot when it comes to dogs. It's just very important to remember that it's not always, and in most cases, not really driven by type 1 hypersensitivity, that there's other hypersensitivity reactions occurring. And then with your non-immunologic, that's just going to be your food poisonings and botulism and things like that that can occur, where the reaction to food is bad, but it's not bad because of the immune response.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that.
You're welcome. And that's like, everyone gets so overwhelmed by the food, the words, like, don't worry about it. I say food allergy, I say adverse food reaction, just say the most, something that's consistent, and you're never going to be in trouble for saying it a little bit differently. As long as what you say, you know what you mean. You know, if you're working up food allergy in dogs, what you're trying to say is, I think that this dog's immune system is overreacting to what it's eating, and as a result, making the dog itchy or making the dog have diarrhea. Therefore, I'm going to go on a diagnostic hunt, and I'm going to start with a diagnostic diet trial. So if you say adverse food reaction, cutaneous adverse food reaction, food allergy, canine food allergy, it doesn't matter to me, because all I care about is how you then make your next step to make a good diagnosis.
Yeah, I like that you mentioned that. Thank you. Because I think sometimes it's so easy to get caught up and overwhelmed in all of that. And really it's more simple than that for sure. Yeah. Cool. And so you actually talked about GI issues, and I was just wondering, like, are dermatologic and GI issues, are they usually seen together?
Yes. And I talk about poop in every appointment. I have a poop chart that I present to every pet owner. I want them to identify what their dog's poop looks like, because I do not want them to say it's normal, because who knows what that means to some different people. And we actually do know what's normal in terms of poop quality and firmness and, you know, frequency, how often dogs are going to the bathroom. This is something that's very relevant. So it is an important consideration and something that we should be asking absolutely in every single appointment of a dog that's presenting to you with skin issues, because it's a really useful little kernel. If this is a dog with ear infections who also has soft stool, I get so excited about those cases, because the chance that I can actually fix them with a diet, I think, is much higher.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I was just wondering as well, if you could describe, like, you know, in the exam, what are sort of the first steps that you take with a dog that has skin problems or GI issues? Like, what is your thought process there?
You know, it's really important to talk to pet owners. I do my own histories. So I know one of the challenges in vet med is just the amount of time that veterinarians are allocated for each appointment. I have 45-minute appointments for initial appointments and recheck appointments. And that works for me. But a friend of mine who does GP, she has 10-minute appointments, 15-minute appointments. Like, how in the world are you able to get through talking and coaching and getting a history and doing all the stuff you need to do? You really need to train up your techs, or you need to have really good resources, like different podcasts that you can send folks to. I'll mention here the Your Vet Wants You to Know podcast, which I did a diet trial episode for pet owners, episode 17. So again, having as many resources as possible when you're a busy, busy general practitioner, just trying to get through the day, seeing 20 cases a day or more. You just don't have enough time to talk about things. But unfortunately, with allergy, like, one of the most important things is just talking. You know, it's essential for me to spend a good 10 minutes at least talking with pet owners. I want to know, where'd you get this dog? You know, when did the issues start? Was this dog 6 months old, 2 years old? Do you notice seasonality? You know, do you notice any specific flares that occur when they get certain treats? Is there anything that you feel flares your dog up? You know, do you have a sense of this? A lot of people come in and they're like, I've known it's the chicken all along, you know, and they just, they're so validated when you ask them these questions. And so the history is an absolutely essential part of any allergic workup or skin workup, because you really want to know when it started, how long it's been happening, and what the patterns are, if any. There's a heck of a lot of a difference between a 2-year-old dog with an ear infection and an 18-year-old dog with an ear infection, you know, like all of a sudden, right? So you really, really want to make sure you understand what the progression of this has been, how chronic it's been, all of those things. And then looking at the pet, you absolutely just do a derm exam. You know, I love derm because I call it external medicine, because it's all on the outside. So a lot of times we're, you know, we don't have to look at the liver, right? So we are able to see the skin and we see it with our eyes, and we can, you know, look and use our otoscope to look in the ears and the ear canal. And then we just look at the skin, see what it looks like. Is it red? You know, is there evidence of infection? You know, what's going on with the actual skin itself? And I think that helps categorize it in terms of severity. You know, is this a, not every dog is the same. In fact, they're all very special little snowflakes, and putting them on a spectrum of mild to severe is a huge part of what I do as well. Where I say, well, you know, this dog's pretty bad, but certainly there's worse, you know, or yikes, this is the worst dog I've seen in the last 6 months, you know, and this means that the skin lesions are just very progressive and much more severe. So putting all of that into context, I think, is really important when you're doing your exam. So good thorough history, and then making sure that your exam is thorough, but just putting things into perspective in terms of severity.
Yeah, thank you. And so can you tell us a little bit more about the diets themselves? Like what I have here, like what is hydrolyzed protein as well? Yeah. And sort of all of that stuff that when you're actually going down to the diet, what do you do?
Great question. So it's very important to have your head around what type of diet you plan to use in practice. And I think at this point, there's enough good evidence that suggests that hydrolyzed foods are superior to whole protein. So basically, when you have your patient in front of you and you're deciding what to do, your first step, just like you said, is to pick a food. Which food are you going to pick? In my opinion, at this time, the benefit to hydrolyzed foods far outweighs the potential benefit to novel protein. So novel protein was totally the way that things went before hydrolyzed foods came to market and were heavily developed for dogs. And what we did was take a thorough diet history and say, all right, it looks like this dog's had chicken and beef. So I'm going to select a rabbit-based diet, and that should be novel to the immune system and less likely to cause a reaction. And in some cases, that would not be wrong. And you might be able to make a diagnosis using a whole protein diet or a novel protein diet. However, there's this issue of potential cross-reactivity between proteins. And so what that means is just that there actually could be some proteins that rabbits and chickens share. And those are things that we might not even know about yet. And these are things that particularly in dogs, there's nobody looking at this. You know, this is not an area that people are writing their PhDs on. And so it, in my opinion, is the potential for having this cross-reactivity potentially makes it so that your diagnostic diet trial will actually not be diagnostic because of cross-reactivity. So you have this unknown potential sensitization to whatever that whole protein was. And that's going to make it so the dog still looks like it has allergy, because it does, you know, it's still allergic to whatever that protein was. And so taking that question out of the equation of cross-reactivity is done by using the hydrolyzed foods that are available. And we have incredibly good and sophisticated hydrolyzed foods available for us at this time in veterinary medicine. So we're very lucky for this. And basically, hydrolysis is a process where we change the size and chemical structure of a protein to make it less antigenic, to make it less reactive. The immune system is less likely to care about it. And the reason for that is because it's smaller, or because we've disrupted the epitope, which is the lock and key that the immune system kind of binds to. So your protein, whatever it is, let's say chicken, and then you have your immune cell, and that's the little lock, and they bind together, and poof, you have an immune reaction. So it eliminates that ability for that lock and key fit to occur because of this epitope disruption. So the hydrolyzed foods really do create less of an immune response as a result of the fact that the food is less antigenic. There's lots of degrees of hydrolysis. There's lots of new technology for this that's available. But in general, it's my opinion and the opinion of many dermatologists that whole protein diets are not adequate for diagnosis. They might be adequate for maintenance, but that's something we can talk about. But for diagnosis, they're not adequate for diagnosis, but they are. The hydrolyzed foods certainly are.
Yeah, thank you for explaining, because I feel like that's kind of the root of like that's what every young veterinarian, I'm sure, just want
to know what to use. Yeah. And, you know, should I use what's on the shelf? And I think it's, you know, there's only so many companies that are out there making pet food, and there's only so many companies that are making prescription diets. And for me, I've always used Royal Canin primarily. I use other foods as well made by other companies, but the Royal Canin foods have been, for me, the most kind of stable in terms of my results. So if I keep my spiel the same, I keep my coaching the same, and I really use the food as, you know, a diagnostic test, I find that within the Royal Canin spectrum, you're able to find a diet that works for pretty much all dogs, mostly because it's very tasty. So a lot of dogs love HP. They're wild for it more than any other food. And so it helps, you know, because ultimately you need the dog to eat the food. Like that'll be your deal breaker if they don't like it. And so I've had a lot of success from just a palatability standpoint with using hydrolyzed foods made by, you know, Royal Canin, but it's something that I just find you got to pick one and kind of stick with that. And if you're feeling like, gosh, I'm not having any dogs come back better, well, maybe you should look at the food you're using or the coaching you're doing, because you truly should. If you're seeing 100 allergic dogs, you probably should be fixing, you know, 20, 25 of them with diet trials alone. So we're usually thinking the incidence of this is about 25% of our non-seasonally allergic population, that food is at least going to help them. So if that's not happening for you, then there's a reason. And it's either your diet just isn't a good one, you know, there's something that's in terms of the level of hydrolysis or the palatability, maybe people are doctoring it up, or your coaching that you're doing for, you know, for pet owners, I think, or potentially both, are things that you need to look at.
Yeah. Do you think veterinarians are well educated about the potential for diet to help atopy patients?
No. I think that even when I was in school, some of my mentors really did not believe in food allergy as a problem. So this is something that really takes getting in with someone who's very keen on diet. So as I went through my residency, I really did find some excellent mentorship, particularly with Craig Griffin and his dedication to food allergy and understanding GI signs and food allergy, you know, clinical manifestations of food allergy. To me, it's just an area that I love, because there's nothing better than helping a dog come off medication, not have ear infections, and have normal poop because I switched one thing and that was their food. And so to me, it's a wonderful diagnosis to make. And it's also, I just don't get why it's not celebrated more and kind of saying, well, this could be it. I think a lot of times people will say things like it's not that common, but it is important even if it's uncommon. And I would argue that it still is pretty common because we see so much allergy. And again, about 25% or 1 in 4 of your patients are going to respond to a diet trial. So to me, that's a ton. You know, if it was 1% of my patients, then that would be exhausting. But it's not, it's almost up to 25% in general. So it's worth it, you know, and it's worth it to those animals that, you know, are suffering from this condition that are misdiagnosed for many years.
Yeah. What would you say as advice to young students or professionals who maybe want to learn more about what you're talking about and really implement these things into their practice in the future, but maybe don't know exactly where to start because they haven't maybe been taught it in a more formal setting. Yeah,
absolutely. So there's a lot of, first of all, when you're starting out, there's so much to know, right? So you have, you know, how do I manage a diabetic cat? And then 6 minutes later, okay, this dog is suffering and we're going to put this dog to sleep. And then 4 minutes after that, it's a new puppy vaccine exam. And then 4 minutes after that, it's a otitis externa case. So don't put a lot of pressure on yourself to get all of this right immediately after you graduate. You know, you are going to develop your craft as a veterinarian and you are going, your main job is to be a functional human, you know, to exist in society, to be happy with your career, to build a good community around yourself and just really feel like your day-to-day is a good one because you matter. And it's so important that you don't burn out, that you just feel fulfilled by this choice of career, which is a great one of veterinary medicine. So keep that at the forefront. Don't get down on like, oh my God, I picked the wrong diet. I just don't know which one, because literally like tomorrow there's going to be six new things that you need to learn or need to do better. And that's just the way it is. It's medicine. It's always going to be changing and evolving. And that's exactly what it should be doing. However, when it comes to learning, I think picking a few things that you really like and going to different conferences to learn about those. And then also looking for online CE opportunities, like, you know, my course on the allergic dog, I definitely think for new grads is going to save you so much time. It's a self-paced 8-hour course. You just sign up. You literally have lifetime access. There's pet owner handouts. There's reading for you. It's so comprehensive when it comes to the medical management of allergic skin and ear disease in dogs. So I think that that's honestly a great place for most new grads to start. And it's the primary reason why I created the course was just to help reduce the overwhelm that occurs when you're faced with being a new grad and now you're on your own. Now you're a doctor, you know, congratulations, here's Fluffy. So helping students kind of cross that bridge and do that confidently is one of my life goals and passions. And so definitely want to help inspire people to stay on track.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Painter, for taking the time to share your advice with us and our listeners, of course. So we end our podcast with like a mini Q&A for our speaker, and it's really brief questions just about you. So my first one,
can't wait.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So my first one, and this is like such a funny one because I used to say it as, what is your ultimate career goal? But yeah. Now I say, what is your ultimate career goal as of now? Because I know that can change. So what would that be for you?
Gosh, my ultimate career goal. That is honestly a really hard question. So I wish that I could have three of myself and that I could have one part be involved in research and do and continue to push my curiosity and questions that I have to publish and create answers to some of the questions that we have in veterinary dermatology specifically. So I'd like to continue along with research. I'd like to continue along with education. So this is something I'm obviously really passionate about, is just talking to people about allergies and getting it right. And then clinical practice. I absolutely love seeing patients. So this is something that I, you know, if I could maintain that trifecta, then that would be the ultimate for me. And I feel like every day you just strive to do all those things and you hope that you did at least one of them pretty well.
That's a really good answer. Cause I feel like that is the truth for most people. It's like, you want to have like a few versions of yourself.
Yeah. Almost. It's so hard to do everything. And you know, you put so much pressure on yourself and you think, oh, I should be doing this. I should be doing that. And the truth is you really just need to get through the day and be a happy person. Like that's step one. So I try to set my expectations pretty low and then just have these goals that are open in mind and, you know, surround myself by people who are really motivated and smart as well. You know, just to be able to accomplish those goals.
Yeah, for sure. And so do you have like a quote or like a philosophy that you live by that helps you get through all these days?
How you do everything is how you do anything.
Ooh, can you explain that one a little?
Yeah. So it's Jess Sims is a Peloton instructor and it's her quote. I don't know if she took it from someone else, but I just took it from her. And it's basically like, if you are going, you know, how you brush your teeth is how you, you know, study for boards, right? So the little things matter, and how you approach little chores, little tasks, little interactions is how you approach anything. And so I, you know, you might just make the bed today, walk the dog, and cook dinner. And if you do that really well and satisfied, then there it is, you know, but don't skimp on the small things, because that's part of life too.
Oh, that's a really good one. I've never
had to say that at all. She says it during workouts and I'm like, oh my God. But it's, she's a great, you know, she's a great instructor. And
you just came out with that right away.
I did. I knew it. It's like, it's mine. I took it, Jess Sims, Peloton. Now Megan Painter, dermatologist.
Well, that's awesome. And yeah, my last question is really just, where can people find you, like email, social media, cool, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah. So I have the amazing Instagram handle of Itchy Pet. And I have no idea how I was able to get that. And I also, if you go to www.theallergicdog.com or theallergiccat.com, then that is where all my courses are for veterinarians. And I am constantly making new courses all the time. So I have two currently that are in progress. I'm making a course on ear disease and then a course on cats. So those are happening, and I hope to launch a course for technicians and then hopefully a course for pet owners, which would really help busy general practice vets just get information across to pet owners in a way that's reliable. So all that stuff I'm doing while working full time, and I have a kid and puppy and all this fun stuff too. But yes, definitely hit up my website, check out my course, and then follow me on Instagram, Facebook too. And I really just love to connect with new vets and find that energy, because it's really exciting, even though I know you guys are tired and overwhelmed, and it's a good time, but it's a weird time too. So I hear you, and I've been there, and it'll be okay.
Oh, well, thank you again, Dr. Painter.
Like, absolutely.
For being here. Yeah. And a big thank you to our Next Pod listeners. Remember, you are the future. Yes. Join us next month for another in-depth talk. Thank you.